So I want to introduce our speaker tonight. For those of you who have never heard her or never met her, she is a real spitfire and as full of energy as anyone that I have ever met in my life. And someone asked me once to describe you, and I thought about it for just a moment, and I said, well, if Dolly Parton was an alcoholic and 30 years younger, then that might be a pretty good description. There are some similarities. But anyway, I just love her to death, and I want to thank her. She drove in today all the way from Montgomery, Alabama, and we just want to welcome Amanda. So help me welcome Amanda B.
She said it costs a lot of money to look this cheap. It's one of my favorite quotes of hers. Hi, family. My name is Amanda Brown. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Amen. By the grace of God, I'm sober today. I want to thank John for asking me to come and speak for y'all this evening. I love coming over here. I tell people all the time, Atlanta's like my second hometown. I have brothers and sisters here in this town and in this room tonight. I love coming over here, and just thank you so much for this opportunity. I want to tell you a little bit about where I'm at today. But first of all, let me get my joke out of the way. I love a good blonde joke, but I recently went through a redhead phase, so I learned one redhead joke. Okay? Hang with me. Okay, so this redhead goes to the doctor, and she says, "Doctor, something's wrong with me. I'm hurting all over the place. Something's wrong." The doctor says, "Well, you know, can you point to where it's hurting? Describe your pain." She's like, "Well, if I point right here to my elbow, that's hurting. Ow, that hurts. And if I point over here to my wrist, that hurts too. Oh, gosh, that hurts so bad. And doc, if I touch up here on my face, on my head, oh, that hurts so bad." And the doctor just looks at her for a minute. He says, "Ma'am, you're not really a redhead, are you?" And she says, "Well, no, doc, I'm not. But how did you know?" He said, "Well, your finger's broken." See, it's really a blonde joke. See, I really love it. I got to tell you, I'm a little, it's different when you're speaking in a church. So if I bend down and start taking my shoes off, don't feel bad. I've just got to take my shoes off. I'm in church. Tell you a little bit about where I am today. God takes care of me. God does for me what I can't do for myself, and I'm very fortunate today that I have learned how to look back and see that. This past week has been a very rough week for me, and the rain certainly isn't helping. I'm sorry I brought the rain with me. I tried to bring you April flowers instead of April showers. I tried to have my best springtime dress on, but the rain just would not cooperate. It has rained for 6 days straight in Montgomery, and it's going to be raining all the way till Tuesday. And so I hate I brought that with me for y'all. But the rain certainly does not help my feelings. I don't know about y'all, but it's seriously, I need some sunshine. I need that vitamin D on a daily basis. This week is the 5-year anniversary that my grandmother passed away. My meemaw, that helped raise me. And I think it's particularly been hard this year because it's also, I lost my mentor back in August, and I'm not through dealing with that yet. My mentor left me a legacy of carrying on an email share, a big book share every day, and I have not been able to go into my computer room since about October. So this past week has been a lot of remembering for me, and remembering my mother and I took care of her the last 2 years of her life. She died of COPD and emphysema. But when Meemaw passed away, it was really kind of funny. I just want to share a few things, and then I'll get into what I was like, because God is just really laying this on my heart today. Meemaw knew that she was dying. She was dying of COPD and emphysema, and fortunately, my mother and I were able to share her and take care of her the last 2 years of her life. And she did not have to go into the nursing home until the last 6 weeks of her life. Thank God, because we had promised her that she would never have to go, but it just physically got impossible for Mom and I to take care of her. It was a Sunday. It was the last time I got to see her with her eyes open. It was 10:09. April 7th, we'll say. My pattern would be I would drop my kids off at school in Montgomery, Alabama, and I would drive the 2 hours south down 231 to Dothan, Alabama, and I would spend 2 to 3 hours with Mima in the nursing home, and I would get back in the car and I would drive the 2 hours back north to Montgomery to be in carpool line to pick up my kids. And I did that every day for 6 weeks. And on the weekends, my children would go with me and they would play in her nursing home room. On this particular Sunday, it was just me and my mother, and we were there with Mima, and she had started filling up with fluid, and we knew it wasn't going to be much longer. Now, my mother and I both speak. She's a blacked out Al-Anon. She's been in Al-Anon 24 years. I forgot to say the principles, but I'll get to that in a minute. So she's a blacked out Al-Anon, and so we have been fortunate to travel and speak, and we were joking with Mima about that we had a conference to go to that weekend. And so that if she was going to die, she better hurry up and get on with it, because we had somewhere to be that weekend. And we knew we was going to have to plan the funeral. You know, we were all joking and laughing about it, you know. That Sunday was the last time I would see her with her eyes open. That Monday, she never opened her eyes again. The nurse came in and asked her and said, "Ms. Raley, are you in a lot of pain?" And she said, "Yes." And my mother was there, and they had a long conversation with the nurse. And the nurse gently and carefully started giving Mima some medicine. And she told Mima, she said, "Now, Miss Dot, I'm going to start giving you these shots, and you're going to close your eyes, and when you wake up, you'll be in the arms of God." And that Wednesday, April 10th, she passed away. We immediately started planning the funeral, and that Friday, that April 12th, my mother and I buried my Mima in Andalusia, Alabama. And when the funeral was over, we drove all the way to North Alabama to Muscle Shoals to the Sweet Home Alabama Jubilee. And that night, my mother and I were sharing our story at a conference, surrounded by AA love, surrounded by Al-Anon love, in the middle of the hand of God. And those people loved us that weekend like I have never felt before in my life. And this weekend is the Sweet Home Alabama Jubilee, and I have some dear friends that are speaking there this weekend. So God knew that I was going to be upset about that this week and having some real feelings this week. So God has protected me this week. See, this past weekend, I was in North Carolina with a very dear friend of mine, Beth H., and her husband, Chuck. And I got to be with her, and I got to share my experience, Strength and Hope, with a room full of women. And they held me in the middle of their hand, in the middle of that AA love and that Al-Anon love. And this weekend, I'm here with you. Not knowing what he was doing, just being obedient to God's will, God laid my name on John's heart, and he asked me to speak here this weekend. And not only do I get to be with you this evening, but I also get to be here tomorrow evening with people I love in the middle of the rooms of AA Love and Al-Anon. And I'm so grateful that God does for me today what I can't do for myself. My sobriety date is May 19th, 1991. My home group is the Legacies Group in Montgomery, Alabama, where we practice all three sides of the triangle. It's on Coliseum Boulevard, right across from the Eastbrook Antique Flea Mall, right next to Pizza Perfect. We have meetings every day now. We recently started having meetings every day. It used to just be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But we have meetings every day at noon. Monday evening is a 6 o'clock meeting. Wednesday evening is the 8 o'clock speaker meeting. Friday night at 8 is the candlelight meeting. And we have a wonderful meeting on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. If you're ever in Montgomery, come on over. I love our home group. I do have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. I actually have two sponsors, and then I've got spiritual advisors on top of that, because, you know, some of us are sicker than others. I need all the help I can get. I will tell you, it has been an interesting 6 months for me. My first sponsor is just turned 80 this past December. She has 27 years of sobriety. Her sponsor is Rambo, who has 51 years of sobriety, but a been-around date of 63 years. She knew Bill and Dr. Bob and Lois, and her big book has everybody's signature in it that you would ever see on any kind of archive site. My other sponsor has been in the around the rooms for 31 years, and her husband is my first big book thumper. He was in my very first meeting when I got out of treatment. My first home group was the Wiregrass Club between Dothan and Enterprise on Highway 84. He has just finished lung cancer treatment. It was a huge tumor, and it's inoperable. And in the middle of having those chemo and radiation treatments, it was going into his bones. And so now they are trying to save one of his arms. But what I have seen and learned during this time, and I mentioned Miss Peggy, her being 80 years old, her mind is starting to go, and her little body is starting to suffer. But what I have learned in this time is that there are other people that I can go to. And it is still just as important for me to call them and use them, because that helps them get out of self. That helps them get their mind off of what they're going through for just those few minutes. They get to reach out and help somebody else. And I tell my sponsees all the time, look, I don't care if I'm out of town. I don't care if something's going on. When in the middle of all that meemaw stuff, I need you to call me. I need you to get me out of self. I do not want to be on this pity pot. Please call me. Allow me to use my experience, strength, and hope and get out of this, whatever it is I'm in. I will share with you a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what life is like for me today. I do have a little over 23 years sobriety, so I'm very excited and never get to talk enough about what life is like for me today. Lots of miracles have happened for me in my life in sobriety. I went back to school and got my college degree. I've been with the same man for 22 years. Who'd have thunk? What an order. I can't go through with it. He is absolutely the love of my life. He is my soulmate. He's an earth person. He's not one of us. He gets naturally what I have to work so hard at. My mother and I have a beautiful relationship today. It is absolutely a miracle. We have worked very hard. She works her program and I work my program. And after Meemaw died, I had some real realizations and was able to work through a lot of that. And I have a relationship with my mother today I never thought possible. I have a beautiful 12-year-old daughter and a handsome 10-year-old son who've never seen their mother drink. They've never been around anybody drinking, because, thanks to these rooms and good sponsorship. I have wonderful friendships today. I have a wonderful relationship with my father today, who this past August celebrated 20 years sober. I'm happy, joyous, and free. Happy, joyous, and free. Doing things differently today than I ever thought possible. I was raised in a small town in Andalusia, Alabama, which is at the bottom of the state. I grew up on beaches of Fort Walton Beach and Panama City Beach. I loved it. I heard a speaker say a few months ago about my first resentment was. My first resentment was that my real father used to beat my mother. And at the time, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And the day he took a shotgun to her and threatened to kill her, she was 6 months pregnant with me. And she called her daddy, my peepaw, to come rescue her, and he did. So that's probably one of my first things I can remember, is my first memory being on the playground at 5 years old, is everybody asking, you know, what do your parents do? And me saying, well, I don't have a daddy, because that was just easier to say than telling the truth. My second resentment was at the age of 8 years old when I got diagnosed with my hearing loss. This was back in the day when they would come around to the schools and you'd go to the library and they'd put them big old black headphones on you and you'd raise your hand when you hear the beeps. Yeah, I never raised my hand. Never heard a beep. So I got stuck on the special ed list. And what that meant for me is for the rest of my life, the rest of my school life, all the way to senior in high school, I was on the special ed list. I had to sit in the front of the classroom. I never got to sit at the back of the classroom with all my friends. Most of my young life, I had to go over here to this fancy little room with a speech therapist because I could not hear the difference in W's and R's. And when I get talking fast today, I still start running all those words together. Now, back in those days, they didn't have hearing aids. They didn't believe in putting hearing aids on children that young. So I was a lip reader. I'm still a lip reader, and I'm fun at parties because I can be sitting over here, and you're at a table over there, and I can be telling my table everything that you're talking about. There are no secrets around me if I can see your mouth. So life rocks on, and I started, you know, building up all these little resentments. And I'm going to skip ahead. Another thing that happened when I was 8 years old was I was forced to make a decision. My mother wanted to go to Birmingham, Alabama, which was 4 hours north of us, and go to UAB College and get her master's degree. She wanted to better herself. Can't blame her for that, except that she was making this little 8-year-old child make a decision. She told me that I could either choose to go live with her or I could stay there in Andalusia. Now, let me tell you a little bit about my life in Andalusia. I am the only child. I'm the first grandchild on both sides. I'm the first great-grandchild on both sides, and I'm the first great-great-grandchild on both sides. I have tons of aunts and uncles and cousins, but to say that I'm selfish and self-centered is an understatement. Mm-hmm. My life revolved around me. I was it. My life did revolve around me. Everything, being the only child, being the oldest grandchild. You know, me and Polly P talk all the time about sometimes I think us only children need to have our own support group. Because it's just a whole other level of selfishness, self-centeredness. My grandfather was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army. I grew up knowing rich folks forks and utensils to use at the table. I grew up knowing that children were to be seen and not heard. I grew up knowing how to answer the phone. Hello, this is Amanda. Excuse me. Lieutenant Colonel Rayleigh's residence. This is Amanda speaking. How may I help you? All of these things I knew how to do, and I was brought up in a certain way and knew to act in a certain way. And everybody looked the same, and everybody kind of talked the same. And in this little town, everybody knew my family. My grandfather was president of the Chamber of Commerce. He was president of the American Legion. My grandmother was the president of the American Legion Auxiliary. She ran the Goodwill there for 10 years. My mother worked for the newspaper. Everybody knew my great-grandparents. Everybody knew me and my family. And I had a big family. So when Mother's asking me to make this decision, what I am thinking about is by this time, she has already been married and divorced a couple of times. And if I go off with her, I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know if that means I'm going to be living in a shack with a tin roof, an orange 70s shag carpet. I don't know if that's going to mean when I lay my head down at night that there may be roaches running across my head and across the windowsill in the bed that I'm laying. I don't know if that might mean another house where we have to get ready when we're turning the lights on, because as soon as we turn the lights on, we got to be jumping on a piece of furniture to outrun the rats and the roaches that are running across the floor. So my mother asked me to make that decision. I said, no, I don't want to go move with you. I want to stay here with me, Ma, and Peepaw. No matter who she was married to or divorced from or whatever, me, Ma, and Peepaw's house was always our safe place. That was my home. We always came back home. So I chose to stay there with me, Ma, and Peepaw, and Mother moves 4 hours north to Birmingham. I like to say in those next 4 years, I began to develop my survival skills. I began to develop those skills to help me survive in the environment in which I had been placed. And I'm going to skip ahead to the age of 12. I heard a speaker say one time, if we could keep alcoholics from turning 12 and being raised in Southern Baptist churches, we'd have a lot fewer alcoholics. And that certainly was true in my case. Feels weird saying that in a church now, I got to tell you. But that was my experience. So I'm going to skip ahead to the age of 12. The first thing that happened that year was I remember learning how to lie. I remember the day that I learned how to lie. Now, my mother had raised me to always tell the truth. My mother had been my best friend, but she's gone now, and she's up there in Birmingham, and I'm having to survive here. And I can remember waking up at night and seeing Mima and Peepaw argue. And, you know, this was back in the days of you didn't dare call Child Protective Services or DHR. This is back in the day of switches and belt whoopings. And so what that, you know, Mima believed in getting them switches. And if you got in trouble in that house, you would have to go outside and get a switch off the rose bush. And if it didn't have enough to it, Mima would go pick the switch for you, and God help you if Mima had to pick the switch. On this particular day, I was a very active child. I remember leaving school and changing clothes in the car, either going to the Baptist Youth Ensemble Choir or going to band practice or going to dance. I went to dance three or four days out of the week. And I would change clothes in the car. And on this particular day, Mima and I have obviously got our signals crossed. And so for 2.5 hours, Mima was at the front of the school waiting on me and hunting me. And I'm at the back of the school waiting on Mima and hunting her. And we don't know where the other one is. And I knew when she found me that it was not going to be pretty. Needless to say, it wasn't. She beat me so bad that day with that switch, I had blood running down my leg from the thorns cutting my legs. I called my mama that day in Birmingham, and I told her what Mima had done. And she drove the 4 hours home that night, and she told my Mima, she said, you will never lay another hand on my daughter. And she didn't. But I can tell you there were many days when I wish she would, because silent scorn and withholding love from a child is so much more powerful than getting the beating. That day I learned to CYA. I learned no matter what happened, I was going to tell a lie. I was going to tell a lie when the truth was good enough. And I began to practice my craft. I became a master at my craft. I became an excellent storyteller. I mean, I told some lies so good, I began to believe them myself. That's what I did. I was never going to get beat like that again, no matter what I had to do. The second thing that happened that year, like I said, I can remember Mima and Peepaw arguing. I can remember getting up in the night wanting a glass of water and going to ask Mima for a glass of water. And Peepaw would be standing there in his military underwear, the white tank top and the white boxer shorts. And there's Mima and her bra and her girdle. And they are going at it outside the bedroom window. Needless to say, I never got my glass of water. I just went back to bed. Well, you know, we lived in the country. We were 5 miles from town. And I loved living out there. And we had a pond. And I loved going fishing with my Peepaw. And it didn't matter if it was raining or whatever, we would be out there fishing on that pond. And on this particular day, Peepaw and I are out there fishing, and we're having a good time. And somehow we start talking about Mima and Peepaw arguing. And I don't know how the conversation came up. It just came up. And I told people, I said, well, why don't you just get a divorce? Mama does it all the time. And I didn't think anything else about that until I came home a few weeks later, a month later maybe. And I came home and I could feel it when I walked in the door. If you grew up in the house like I did, you develop certain skills, and I could read a room real quick. And I walked in the room, and there's Meemaw sitting in her spot at the dining table, and her face is all red, and that's unusual because Meemaw doesn't cry. She's very stoic. And then I look over there at Peepaw, and I've never seen him cry in my life, and his face is red, and his cheeks are red, and he is obviously upset. Peepaw says, come here, Amanda, I want you to come over here and sit in my lap. And so I go over there and I go and sit in his lap. And he says, Amanda, do you remember that day we were talking on the pond? We were fishing and we were talking about me and Meemaw arguing. And I said, well, yes, sir. He said, well, do you remember what you said? And I said, yes, sir, why don't you get a divorce? And he said, well, we are. So you see, in my 12-year-old mind, it was all my fault. If I had not said the words out loud, the seed would not have been planted, and Meemaw and Peepaw would not be getting a divorce. It's all my fault. Oh, my God, I have destroyed my home. What am I going to do? My safe place is about to be broken up. Oh, my God, Amanda, why don't you just keep your mouth shut? Why did you have to say that? It's all my fault. It's all my fault. Now, the reality of that situation was, Peepaw had decided to have an affair with Meemaw's married best friend, who proceeded to divorce her husband, marry my Peepaw, and they built a house across the pond that my Meemaw could see out the kitchen window the rest of her life. But I didn't know that until later. The third thing that happened that year was my mother had always told me that I could always find my real father when I was 12 years old. Well, you know what? I'm not having such a good time. Maybe the grass is greener. Maybe I can find my real father and he's rich and can take me away from all this chaos. Maybe he's sane and maybe he can take me off somewhere exotic like California. Take me out of Alabama. You know, started dreaming these dreams of what all he could do for me if I could just find him. So I told my mother, yes, let's find my real father. So she starts making phone calls, and lo and behold, she calls my grandma, his mother, and he's living in her basement. That should have been clue number one right there. So my mother and I and my favorite aunt, my Aunt Muck, traipse off to Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is where my father was living. We get there on an afternoon, and we knock on the door, and my grandma Bradley answers the door in what I'm sure was her best nightgown. So we meet grandma, and we're hugging grandma, and there she is. And then the biggest man I've ever seen in my life comes to the doorway, and he is as wide as a doorframe, and he's 6'6", and he's got white hair, and he's an NRA president, KKK card-carrying hillbilly from Tennessee. That's Grandpa Bradley. Well, hi, how are you? So I'm hugging my grandpa, and we go in the front room and sit up front, and I'm looking at all the locked gun cabinets on the walls of the front sitting room, and I have never met people like this or seen anything like this before in my life. So we're sitting there having a conversation. I hear a noise I've never heard before outside. Harley, 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 Harley. Comes up the driveway today. I know it was a Harley Davidson motorcycle. And the only way I know how to describe what happened next was I looked out the window, and there's a woolly booger sitting on a motorcycle. If you don't know what a woolly booger is, just picture Bigfoot, Sasquatch, sitting on a motorcycle. That's what it looked like to me. Big, hairy beast. It gets off the motorcycle. It's got a beard down past its belly button. It's got hair all the way down to its butt. It is covered in tattoos, and this one says F off. And I had never even heard that, let alone seen it in ink on somebody's body. It comes in the door, and it comes to the door of the sitting room, and it says, well, aren't you going to hug your old man? No, no. No, I'm not. That was the other half of me. The grass wasn't greener. He wasn't going to take me nowhere, and I needed a drink. Oh, Lord, I'll never forget that. It wasn't long after that that I did take my first conscious drink of alcohol. And I say conscious because as a child, I grew up, my great-granddaddy made the best scuppling wine ever made on this earth. And on holidays, us children would get a little glass full of it. And I can remember drinking that sweet wine and giving that glass back to Mama saying, please, can I have some more? Oh, I couldn't wait for the holidays. That stuff was fine. But on this particular time, you know, and what I knew of alcohol was that it was a social event. You know, I mentioned Peepaw was over there at the American Legion Auxiliary, American Legion. Any Friday night, we would be at the American Legion playing bingo. Any Saturday night, we might be over there having a dance. We had ponds, and we lived out in the country. We had fish fries at our house all the time. Meemaw and Peepaw had tons of friends. I got a big old family. Aunt Mutt would come over there and start drinking, and she'd get that red nose and them red cheeks and start telling the best jokes. Uncle MC would come over and get that red nose and them big red cheeks and start telling the best stories. Oh, gosh, I wanted to be a storyteller like them. So I associated alcohol with fun and social, and it's just what you did when you got a bunch of people together who cared about each other. On this particular evening, my best friend was a guy, his name was Tim, and his daddy had a house down in Panama City Beach. And so a bunch of us one weekend went down there to the beach, and his daddy starts going around and taking everybody's drink orders. Well, Tim said he wanted a six-pack of peach wine coolers. So I said, well, you know, that sounds pretty good. I think that's what I'll have. So his daddy takes off and goes wherever he goes and comes back with all of our drink orders. I drank every single one of that six-pack of peach wine coolers and proceeded to have the best night's sleep of my little life. I immediately enjoyed the effect it produced. I have been a blackout drinker from day one. I blacked out that night. But here's what it did for me. When I say the best night's sleep of my little life, from my earliest childhood memories, I can remember laying in bed at night and not being able to go to sleep. Worrying, 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 worrying. Fear, fear, fear. Who's mama going to marry now? Well, now what's going to happen to us now that she's divorced him? Where are we going to live? I don't want to live in a place that's got roaches. And now I've destroyed my home. I've messed up me and my own people. Now I don't have a safe place. And oh my God, he married that boop. And now they're living over there across the pond. And I don't like her. And what's going to happen to me, mom? And oh my God, what's going to happen to me? And all night long. All night long. So when I blacked out, all the voices in my head shut up. They shut up. Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful to get a good night's sleep. Now, I don't believe that I started drinking alcoholically from that moment, but I can tell you that at every opportunity that presented itself from that moment on, I would drink. And I would drink to the point of blacking out. I became a thief. I would steal money out of whoever's wallet and purse was in the house to get me some liquor. I would steal Meemaw's liquor. I would get me a Sprite bottle and I would fill it up. I would get under her kitchen cabinet and steal her 151 Bacardi rum. I would pour all the Sprite out of the bottle and I would fill it up with that rum. And I'd be sitting there at the dinner table and they think I'm drinking a Sprite and I'm getting my drink on right here at the dinner table. You know, Andalusia is a very small town. It's not that big. There wasn't a whole lot to do. So on any given Friday or Saturday night, we're drinking. It's about 2 miles through town, and there's a Hardee's on this end and a McDonald's on this end. And we would mix drinks in that Hardee's parking lot, and we would drink them right through town, right through the town square, right by the movie theater, get all the way down there to McDonald's. By then, I'm on empty. Got to get in the parking lot and mix the drink again, and we'd do it all again. All night long on a Friday night. Friday night parties after the football game. Saturday night field parties. Over at friends' house. I'm getting friends that their parents let them drink, or their parents may have liquor in there. I'm doing the deal. I'm doing what I've got to do. I was still busy. I was still an overachiever. I made good grades. I graduated from high school and got to go to the University of Alabama. It had always been a dream of mine to play in that million-dollar band up there. And I had 415 brand-new best friends. And on Thursday night was the Green Book party after band practice on Thursday night. Friday night was the party before the game. Saturday was the party after the game. I'm either celebrating or commiserating. Either way, I'm getting drunk. Sunday, I'm a big pro football fan. I love the Dallas Cowboys. And so I'm watching pro football somewhere on TV, and my disease began to progress. My disease is progressing. I drunked out my first semester of college. My mother told me I had to move home, and I said, oh, no. And I got a little apartment up there, and I got a job in a restaurant that had a bar in it. And my disease progressed. The whole paragraph in the big book where it talks about here are some methods we have tried, I have done every single one of those. I used to say there was one I had not done, but really it was a technicality. My sponsor called me out on it because I used to say I didn't drink in the morning. Well, that was because I wasn't getting up till 2 or 3 in the afternoon. That was my morning. As soon as I was up, I was hunting it. My disease progressed. February 19th, 1991 was a terrible day in my little life. My big mama passed away. She was the one somebody in my life who unconditionally loved me no matter what. It didn't matter if I made a C in school. It didn't matter if I had just wrecked Mama's car trying to sneak a look over there at my boyfriend. It didn't matter whatever was going on. You know, Big Mama was going to love me no matter what. And she was a Big Mama. She was about this tall. And I'd get over there after school, and she had baked me some macaroni and cheese with sausage like I like it, with the welfare cheese. I mean, just love. Nothing but love. Nothing but love. And when she died, God, I remember getting the news, and I had already been drinking that day. Because by now, I'm drinking pretty much around the clock. And my best friend named Michelle, she came and got me because I was too drunk to drive to Andalusia. And she drove me to Andalusia for the funeral. And I can remember talking to her on the way down there. And I remember telling her, you know, Michelle, I was raised in that Southern Baptist church. And I can see Brother Foster up there slamming that Bible on the podium, telling me that I'm going to hell. Because even to think it is a sin, just like doing it is a sin. And you know what? I have thought and done some things these last few years that I'm not proud of, and I know that I'm going to hell. Let me see how fast I can get there. I don't remember Big Mama's funeral. I don't remember being there. I don't remember getting back to Tuscaloosa. I don't remember the next 3.5 months. I know that I had no contact with my mother or my grandmother for the next 3.5 months. I have a few memories of that time, and I believe God has allowed me to have those memories to remind me of what it was like so that I don't have a desire to go back. And I'll share some of that with you. You know, I would come to anywhere. If I came to in a bedroom or something, I'm looking for the empties. I'm checking to see if anything's got liquid left in it. And then I'm going in your bathroom. And I'm looking to see if you've got NyQuil, if you've got cough syrup, if you've got Listerine. Have you got perfume? Have you got anything in there with some kind of alcoholic content? And then I'm going in your kitchen praying you got the real vanilla extract, not the imitation stuff. And then my next thought is, how do I get out of where I am? And how do I get me some more alcohol? And how do I get me some money to get me some more alcohol? Now, mind you, at the time, I'm 19 years old. I've never been carded. Never been able to buy alcohol legally. I'm doing things behind Winn-Dixie parking lots and Piggly Wiggly parking lots that no young girl ought to be doing to get what she needs to have on a daily basis to survive when you've got the disease of alcoholism. I'm making deals. I'm getting what I have to have, whether it's me paying somebody to go in there and get it for me or doing what I got to do. I remember one of my memories is woke up in a concrete stairwell. I believe it was an apartment complex. And my head is over a big black industrial trash can. And I am covered in vomit and pee and poop and blood and just gross. Just gross. I don't know how long I've been there. One of my memories is there's all these flashing lights. There's these bright lights and this sound. Oh, my God, all the sounds. And it's just so loud. And something feels so rough on my back. God, my back is scraping. And she's got my feet. Why does she have my feet? And she's dragging me. She's dragging me. And there's all this lights and noise. And McFarland Boulevard is the busiest street in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I have decided to lay down and take a nap in front of oncoming traffic. And my friend is trying to pull me out of the highway. 4 lanes of traffic. One of my memories is I'm standing in a club and I'm standing there listening to the band, and by this time my body has changed. The chemical properties in my body has changed, and I have switched from liquor to beer. Not only was beer cheaper, but it got me drunk faster. I can handle a lot of liquor, and I used to win a lot of bar bets. But if I could get that beer in me, I could get drunk a lot faster. And so I'm switched to beer, and I've got a cigarette in this hand and a Miller Lite long neck in this hand, and I'm standing there and I'm dancing to the band, you know, and I proceed to crap all in my pants. And I just take a puff and take a swig and rock on. I don't care. One day there was a knock at my door, May 18th, 1991. There was a knock at my door in my apartment. I had not been in very long. I had been partying all night. And I was kind of curious. By now, I'm very paranoid. Part of my disease is that at some point, I would want to try to feel better. At some point, I would want to try to stop feeling what I'm feeling because I realize on some level that what I'm doing is not right and that what I'm doing is not normal. I'm not eating. I'm not sleeping. The only thing in my refrigerator is cherry Kool-Aid and raw cookie dough. I can't keep anything down. I'm about this big around. But part of my disease was that I would want to feel better. And what that looked like for me was that I had a checkbook and it had checks in it. And so I might go shopping. I might go buy me a whole new wardrobe. Or I might buy you a whole new bedroom suit. And we would go over to the University Mall and I would write checks. And it never occurred to me that just because there were checks left doesn't necessarily mean there's money in that account to back that up. So by now, there's all these brown, official-looking documents in my mailbox outside my apartment. I'm scared to death because they say federal government, and they have my name on there. So there's this knock at my door at May 18th, and I am paranoid and terrified, but I'm also nosy. It's a character defect. I'm aware of it today. I believe awareness is 95% of any problem, and I am aware. But on this particular day, you know, I went and I put my ear to the door. I wanted to hear who was outside. Who's knocking on my door? So I waited for the voices to leave. Now, I told you I'm nosy. That's not good enough. I got to open the door and see who it was, right? So I open the door, and there's my mother's best friend standing there, and she hollers down the walkway, Angie, Angie, she's here, she's here. And my mother comes running down the walkway and she tells me she loves me and it's going to be okay. One of the reasons why I say by the grace of God I'm sober today is it starts right here in my story. My mother was having nightmares. She was having nightmares of coming to Tuscaloosa and having to get the landlord to open the apartment because I won't answer the door. And her opening the door and being hit with this tremendous smell. And going in there and finding me dead, naked, on my bed. And she had that dream where she couldn't stand it anymore, and she showed up at my apartment that day on May 18th. She gave me an option that day. She said, "Amanda, I don't know what's going on with you. We haven't talked in so long, but I know something is wrong." She said, "Now we can go and have a nice lunch, and I'll hug you and tell you I love you and I'll leave you alone. Or you can decide to get some help. I don't know what's going on, but something's up." She gave me 2 hours to make that decision, and she went off with one of her best friends and left the other best friend with me. And I told that best friend that I might have written a few bad checks. So she proceeds to call all your friends in Andalusia. And he tells her, "Oh, Melody, Tuscaloosa County is the worst county in Alabama to write a bad check. How many has she written?" And she says, "Well, I don't know, because I didn't even know." And so I could tell by the tone of the conversation that this was not going to be good for me, and I might want to decide to get some help. So Mama comes back, and I say, "Okay, I'll get some help." So I quit my job. We loaded up everything in that apartment. We drove the 4 hours from Tuscaloosa to Andalusia. We got a couple hours sleep. We got up in the dark 30 morning, and we drove 4 hours from Andalusia to Mobile, Alabama. May 19th, 1991 is my sobriety date. At 9 o'clock that morning, I was on the 10th floor of Providence Hospital in Mobile on the psychiatric unit. And I will never forget the sound of those doors closing behind me. You know, I was very fortunate. God did for me what I could not do for myself. I got to spend 60 days in that treatment center on that psych ward. I don't remember a lot of the first week there, but I remember one day I accidentally told my counselor that I might have drank a little bit. He was a recovering alcoholic, and he recognized in me things in himself, and so he started sending me to those AA meetings. I turned 20 when I was in treatment. Another way that I know God was watching out for me is that man that Mama was married to at that time, she thought that she had married him to get me a college degree. He was rich enough to be able to send me to college. But we found out later that the real purpose for him being in her life was that his insurance covered every single thing of my treatment center bill. $50,000. I know God was watching out for me because 3 months later that treatment center closed. I know God was watching out for me because that man who recognized something in me that he saw in himself was a psychiatrist, also a recovering alcoholic. He died 6 months later of brain cancer. God had me in the palm of his hand. I started going to those AA meetings, and for a long time I listened to the differences. I didn't want to hear the similarities. I wanted to hear the differences. I was young. I had never slept under a bridge, technically. I had never drank out of a brown paper bag, technically. You know, there was a lot of technicalities in there for me. I was hiding behind my hair. I didn't want you to shake my hand. I didn't want anything you had to offer to me. I didn't belong there. I was different. And then one day at the Alano Club down there in Mobile, a young lady got up there, and it was a speaker meeting, and she told my story. And I could no longer deny who and what I was. She told my story. She drank like I did. She had done the things that I had done, and she had cleaned up and gotten sober. She was up there telling me, you know, how her life had changed and how she was happy, joyous, and free today. And I wanted what she had. There was something about her that gave me hope. She's saying that she's an alcoholic. Well, okay, she's sober today. Well, how did she do that? And she's telling me how she did that. Well, that gave me hope because maybe I'm an alcoholic. And maybe there is a solution for me. And so I began to hear the similarities as I began to go to meetings. I stopped listening for the differences. My ears were opened up and things had changed. When I left treatment center, I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know if I was going to prison or if I was going somewhere else. They had collected all those brown official-looking documents in that mailbox, and I was looking at 15 years in Junior Tutwiler Prison, which is the women's prison, 20 minutes from where I live today. And that would be just to cover the money. That wouldn't be what the judge would give me on top of that. That would be the minimum that I would serve. My mother had went to every single place that I had written a bad check, $10,000 worth, and she had paid that money back. And when I left treatment that day, she told me that, and I had to sign a contract saying I was willing to pay her back that money in 10 years' time. And I signed that contract, and I went to live with her, and my first home group was the Wildgrass Club there between in Level Plains, Alabama. I remember walking in that clubhouse for the first time and seeing, I was told this was going to be my sponsor, and this was my grand sponsor. And those two women raised me up. I remember after that first meeting, Gloria told me something that I will never forget. She said, Amanda, you never have to take another drink of alcohol ever again if you don't want to. She took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She told me about my disease and taught me about the doctor's opinion and what all that looked like. And I love analogies, and she gave me a wonderful analogy that night. She said, Amanda, think about it like this. She said, think about that if you were eat up with cancer and you were told tomorrow down there at the CVS they were going to be giving away little blue pills that would cure your cancer, would you go down there and get that little blue pill? Well, yeah, I'd be first in line. I'd be camped out there for a week ahead of time. I want that little blue pill to cure all my cancer. She says, okay. She said, you have the disease of alcoholism. You're an alcoholic, and this is your little blue pill. And you got to take it every day. And this has a fancy cover on it, but this is our textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what the spiritual program of action that I practice every day is in this textbook. The prayers that I learned to pray are in this textbook. How to live my daily life are in this textbook. What to do when calamities come is in this textbook. In here it tells me that our spiritual program of action will solve all my problems. In here it teaches me that there is a solution. That one is God. May you find Him now. And she began to walk me through that big book. And I do my best to take my little blue pill every day. I'll skip ahead now to sobriety. You know, getting sober was not easy for me. I had 3 different jobs in 2 different counties and no car. I had people in the rooms of AA lined up to help me. Help me get to where I needed to go. Those people raised me up. I believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in the fellowship. And I believe in the service work. You know, I really hate it for the people coming up today that they don't get to go on 12-step calls. Because let me tell you, there were so many times in my young sobriety, the AA hotline phone was in our clubhouse. And so when my sponsor had a shift, that meant that I had a shift. And so I'd have to be there with her. And I got to go on those 12-step calls. And people, there were days when I might have wanted to think about taking a drink. And we'd go over there and be on that 12-step call. And God, I don't want to take a drink anymore. God, keep me sober today. Oh, my goodness. I hate that our young people aren't getting to do so much of that today. She took me through the steps. She took me through the traditions. So many people don't practice that today, but the traditions is where I learned to practice these principles in all my affairs. The traditions are the reasons why I can sit in a business meeting. That is where I learned principles of both personalities. Oh, my gosh, I'll never forget. Some of the most knock-down, drag-out business meetings were when this one would be smoking and this one wasn't, because now she's got to be on an oxygen concentrator. So now we've got to decide on which meetings are going to be smoking or non-smoking. Oh, my gosh, knock-down, drag-outs. You think we're having World War III in there. But when we sit in that Lord's Prayer at the end of that business meeting, and they're hugging, and it's all let go, it's done. And they're able to sit there in the same meetings together. And it's nothing but brother and sisterly love after that. That's where I got to learn all of that. And the concepts, which the concepts still kind of throw me off. But I still, you know, I'm still willing to learn. I'm still teachable. She told me, she said, Amanda, she said, how do you, I asked her one day, I said, Gloria, how do I get sober? She said, the answer's in the how. Got to be honest. You got to be honest. You got to be honest with yourself. You got to be honest with me as your sponsor. You got to be honest to God. You got to be open-minded. You got to be open-minded to maybe your way is not working, and maybe I've got a suggestion for you. And then you have a choice. You can either take the suggestion or not. Go be miserable. Have fun with it. Suffer. But I'm giving you a suggestion because I've done this and I know this works. She said, and then you got to be willing. You got to be willing to take the suggestion. You got to be willing to do something different. You got to be willing to replace the bad habits with good habits. And I listened to her. I listened to her. She helped me get rid of those old tapes and put the new tapes in. She helped me replace the bad habits with good habits. She taught me how to get dressed on a daily basis. I would come in a meeting and she would say, oh, no, go back and try again. Because I would come in looking like a hoochie mama. Because I'm young and I'm cute. And she would say, oh, no, ma'am, you cannot be a distraction to that young brother sitting next to you. You may be the reason why he doesn't hear something that he needs to hear that's going to save his life. Go try again. Cover them girls up. Put some pants on. She taught me how to dress. She taught me how to act like a lady. The ladies in these rooms have taught me how to be a lady, have taught me how to be a good wife, how to be a good girlfriend, how to be a good mother, how to be a good friend, how to be a good daughter. The people in these rooms have raised me up and taught me those things. I continue to go through the steps. I'm not one of those people who believe you can do them once and done. I don't believe in that for me. Because what I know today is I want to continue to grow. My book tells me that I have to continue to grow along spiritual lines. And that this process continues for a lifetime. And I will tell you that looks a lot different for me today than it did when I first got sober. These past 2 years have really been for me about seeking. I want to seek conscious contact. I read a book this past year and it talked about to ask is to use your words, but to seek is to go after the prize, to go after the treasure. Well, to me that implies action. I've got to go out there, I've got to seek it, and I've got to find it. And so God is bringing to me all different ways to seek and to find. I no longer say the God of my understanding. I say the God of my experience, and I'll share with you why I say that. You know, and I was raised up saying God of my understanding, but what I know today is, and especially the last few years, is I'm never going to understand God. I'm never going to understand how He works or why He does what He does. And not only that, today I don't want to put Him in that kind of box. I don't want to limit Him to my understanding. I say the God of my experience. I have experiences with God on a daily basis. I have my own conception of God. I know how my sponsor helped me work with that conception of God. I'll briefly tell you, the first time we went through the steps, I came in here with that Hellfire and Brimstone and Southern Baptist version. And she got a big old yellow legal pad and she said, okay, Amanda, we're going to draw a line down this pad. And on the left side, we're going to write down everything that you think God is today. And I wrote down words like Zeus, lightning bolt, vengeful, hateful, jealous, throwing lightning at me, mean, angry. So she said, okay, I got all that done. And she said, okay, now on this right side of the paper, I want you to write down words that you want God to be. Write down what the kind of God that you would like to have in your life. So the first thing I put was Santa Claus. I love me some Christmas. I want Santa Claus. I want the red nose and the red cheeks and the jolly belly and laughing. I want laughing and joyful and happy and gentle and forgiving and kind and cuddly and sweet and loving. And I wrote down all that on the right side of the paper. We ripped that paper in half. And that left side, all those angry, mean words, that current conception, I ripped it up and shredded it into a can. And we burned that up. And as that smoke was rising, she was praying over me. And she was praying that as that smoke is rising, I'm letting go of that old conception. I'm letting go of that those old ideas. She said, okay, man, I want you to carry around this right side of this paper with you. And I want you to start praying to this God. And I know it's not conference approved today, but I can't help it. I'm going to mention it anyway. I got sober with the big book and the 12 and 12 and the little 24-hour day book. And that little book helped me get a relationship with the God of my experience more than any other book. So I began to pray to that God. And so what that looks like for me today is I can have experiences anywhere. I had experience in with Lynn in the car today. Oh, I forgot to mention her. I'll mention her here at the end. I had experiences with her in the car today. I've had experiences with Jonas, my spiritual brother, sitting up here. I have experiences on the beach. One of my favorite journal entries I ever wrote down was, I love going to the beach and I love collecting seashells. And I've been a seashell snob most of my life. Now, what that means is I want the perfect ones, right? On this particular day, and it was when Meemaw was getting close to passing and making her transition, I noticed that I'm picking up different shells. I'm picking up shells with holes in the middle of them, and I'm picking up shells with certain kinds of cracks in them, and I'm talking to God about, God, why are you having me picking up these shells? They're not perfect. They're cracked. They've got holes in them. He said, that's right. That's all my children. That's you. But I love you anyway. Pick it up. And I will tell you, those shells have a very special place in a very special jar in my home today. That's an experience that you cannot take away from me. These are experiences that you can't argue with me about. These are my experiences. I've had experiences going and traveling. I've had experiences hiking in the woods. I've had experiences in Catholic chapels. I've had experiences with Native American brothers and sisters. You cannot take those experiences away from me. You cannot argue about those experiences. You can try, but they're mine. So that's why I say the God of my experience today. Because I can never understand Him, but I can share my experiences with you and I can express to you in ways how God reveals Himself to me in my life. And I continue to want to seek Him. I continue to want that conscious contact. Someone recently explained it to me. You know, I can have faith in God. I can have faith that when I turn a light on, that electricity is going to come on. Y'all have heard those examples. I can have faith that the police is out there protecting and serving. But when that blue light is flashing right behind me and has pulled me over, I've got conscious contact. I am in the middle of the moment with God. Oh, God, please. See, there's a difference there, right? That's what I'm seeking today. I want that conscious contact. I'll tell you one of the most powerful tools that my sponsors have taught me is gratitude. That's one of the reasons why I say I'm a grateful alcoholic today. I hated writing when I came into these rooms. I hated writing. I did not want to keep a journal. Excuse me. I did not want to write anything down because I just didn't. For one reason is that made it real. That changed my perspective. I'd rather keep it up here and make it huge and ginormous, right? When I put it on paper, my sponsor can help me and really see it for what it is. But through the years, I have begun to practice that gratitude list. When there was a period right around 8 or 9 years of sobriety, it was one of my phases of my development, spiritual growth spurts, we like to call them. And I was having trouble sleeping, and I was going through a hard time. And my sponsor said, Amanda, why don't you do an alphabet gratitude list when you go to sleep at night? So I would lay my head down at night, and I would go, okay, letter A. And it would start out where I would just list one thing, but now I try to list two or three things, things that I'm grateful for. So I'll start with letter A. Okay. Annabelle, Angie, Amy. Okay, letter B. Bungie, boys, bows. Letter C, my car, cash. And I would go all the way down the list, right? And I would try to list two or three things for each letter. I've never made it to Z. When I get up in the morning and my children wake up and we get in that car and we're going somewhere, we're making a gratitude list to wherever we're going. For me, it diffuses whatever fear or sad feeling or bad feeling that I'm having. That gratitude replaces it, and it helps change my perspective. And today, it's one of the most powerful tools that I have in my possession. How I teach it to my sponsees is, and I've learned this the last few years, is I have them write down every day. The first three things I want them to write down is thank you, God, for. Thank you, God, for. Just write down three things. Thank you, God, for the rain that helps the flowers and bloom and the river refresh. Thank you, God, for Lynn picking me up today, because God knows I don't know where I'm going over here in Atlanta, and I'm so glad that she picked me up and brought me over here today. Thank you, God, for John asking me to speak here this weekend and helping me get out of cell. That's an easy way to start practicing the gratitude list. And then I have them write, God, I want you to know. Because what I know today is I want to have a conversation with that higher power. I want to have a running dialogue with him. I want him to be right here beside me, not way out there somewhere where I can't reach him. I want him to be right here with the pew, sitting by you and you and you. I want him to be in my ever-present moment. So what I have learned is, in my God, I want you to know, is it's really interesting sometimes what will come out, because I'm one of those people, if I don't say it out loud, it's not real, right? I know I'm not the only one who thinks like that. Because if I just keep it in my head and I don't say it out loud to God, it's not real and it's okay. But once I say it out loud to God, it's real and it's happening and it's here. So in my God, I want you to know, God, I want you to know, I'm really missing my meemaw this week. God, I want you to know, I really miss my mentor, dear, and I really don't want to go back in that computer room. God, I want you to know, I'm willing to do what you would have me do today. Whatever it is, start the conversation. And so it helps me, and seeing the fruit of the labor, I can see it in my sponsees, helps them have a running conversation with God. Because without him, I am nothing. I know today, as I keep going back through the steps, I'm peeling my layers of my onion. See, I'm just a big old Vidalia onion. And you know, when you go in that grocery store and you get that Vidalia onion, that brown layer kind of comes off kind of crumbly. Just, there it is, it's gone, right? Okay, well, maybe that's me the first time I went through the 12 steps. That next layer that comes off, you don't need a knife. You just get your thumb and you kind of pull it off, right? Well, maybe that's my next layer of going through the steps. And every time I'm going through the steps, I'm seeing a different character defect. I'll never forget the first character defect God showed me was lying. I had to get honest. I had to start telling the truth. The second one was thieving. I had to stop taking money out of my meemaw's wallet. I had to stop taking money out of my mother's purse. I had to get honest about that. Stop being a thief. God don't like a thief. And every time I've gone through, there's been something new. A few years ago, it was control. My children are getting a little older, and I'm having to relinquish control of them. Because you see, they are precious children of God. They're not mine. They came through me, but they're not mine. They're His. And so I really struggled that year with letting go of that control of them. And every year it's been something new. And every time I peel another layer of that onion, it gets just a little harder. Just a little harder. Alcohol is a subtle foe. It's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful. And it can rear its ugly head at any given moment. Sometimes in calamity, but sometimes in times of joy. Because you see, that alcoholism for me rears its head more times when everything is even Steven. When I'm resting on my laurels, that's when that snake comes start talking to me in my ear and telling me lies that I want to hear. When calamities are happening, that's when it's easier for me to stay in the middle of my program. But what I know today is the more I get down to the center of that onion, now I'm having to use a knife. Now God's having to use a knife because now it's getting more subtle. I didn't realize how materialistic I was. I didn't realize how judgmental I have been. I didn't realize all, you know, those things about myself until I started getting into the core. And what I know today is that core is the woman of dignity and grace that the God of my experience wants me to be. And every time I go through the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, He's bringing me closer to the woman of dignity and grace that He would have me be today. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not be here without it. I love good sponsorship. I think that's where we're seeing the biggest missing link today is in good sponsorship. I will have to pass on the way that I was raised up in here. I'm not here to save your feelings. My sponsees get their feelings hurt a lot, and I tell them, I'm so sorry. Go pray about it. I'm not here to save your feelings. This is life or death, and I want to help save your life. I want you to help find this solution because it's not about me. It's about you and your relationship with God. I always close with this particular passage. It's very meaningful to me. There was a man named Mr. Bill Bailey who helped raise me up in this program, and he died with 28 years sobriety. And when he got sober, it was when the second edition came out, and he was in prison. And when he was in prison, they gave him a second edition big book, and he recovered it while he was in prison. And right before he passed away, he gave me that second edition big book. And he circled this paragraph. And he wrote in there, he said, Amanda, if you will abide by this, you will know true happiness. I didn't understand that for a long time. And years later, my mentor, Sweet Diz Teacher from Tallahassee, Florida, took me to that page and worked that paragraph with me and explained to me how all 12 steps are in this one paragraph. And it's the last paragraph on page 164 in the big book. And I'd like to close with that with you today. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. My name is Amanda Brown. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.